I'm in a strange mood today, so I'm super sorry in advance. I have no idea why it happened, but here we are. And? All right. Oh, are there any, is there a representative of the board here? No. Huh. Oh, that, Michelle? Yes, this is for Michelle. Actually, it's for her to hang on to. Someone donated a set of prayer flags to the KTC, and someone thought that those prayer flags belonged to me. And so I looked at the prayer flags, and this wonderful lady from Iowa said that she couldn't help us rebuild our center because, you know, she didn't have, like, super lots of money or anything. But what she did have were these prayer flags. And so she wants me to have these prayer flags so we can hang them over the door of our new place. And so once I read her letter, I understood what it was all about and why she was giving them to us, because before I wasn't 100% sure. So now I'm handing those over to Michelle on behalf of the board. She'll be our representative, and she'll give those to the board there. So very good. So, thank you, Michelle. We just started talking about you. The lady from Iowa who sent us the prayer flags, could you hold on to them for me for now? Because it turns out from her little letter that she actually intended them to go in our new building. She couldn't give us a donation, but she wanted to give us something that would have a little bit of, what do you call it, the Dharma staying power, you know, some kind of like intention. And I'm figuring we might be able to use it in one of the libraries or something, hang it over the door or some such. And, you know, sort of in honor of all the people who are on our prayer team. Because, you know, I think some of you, actually I called some of you in the last like 3 weeks because I was given the assignment to finish the list of 50 people to call for donations for the local Sangha fundraising effort for the new building. And so I spoke to some of you personally and left messages for some of you. And it was delightful to check in with people and hear what they're doing. And for some people, I told them that they said, well, you know, we've given the money we can give this year and so forth and so on. I said, great, now you're on the prayer team. Now you have a different job. Your job now is to be on our prayer support team, offering us close prayer support. Get it? Close prayers. Never mind. Okay. Military term. Didn't work. Okay. Close prayer support to help us rebuild the center. And we had another meeting with the architects this week and learned more cool things. And hopefully they'll be having more plans for us to look at in January of the interior. We've seen the plans of the exterior. Now we're going to be looking for the plans of the interior. So we're all pretty excited about it. Our architects are telling us now that we may be able to go to the city officials for exterior approval in February. They've already approved one plan, but now we have to bring them the rejuvenated plan. If you remember, the city of Columbus asked us to put a ramp on the front of the building, and so we're doing it. So Thomas, we got you covered. All right, it's Thomas' first visit today. So we're going to put a ramp on the front of the building, come right in the front door. So it's going to be lovely, and we're going to have a nice shrine inside that everybody can get. Yes, we should have that. If we don't have one, we should get one. But they have it here.
I saw it.
They're very helpful. They're very helpful.
They are.
Mm-hmm. So since you're new today, I'll tell you what happens during the Dharma talks. During the Dharma talks, I ramble on for about 15 minutes, and then I ask for questions. The reason I do it this way is because if people ask me questions in the middle of my talk, I have this gray hair problem and I'm forgetting things. Okay, very good. So from this point of view, I won't be able to entertain questions while I'm speaking, but every 15 minutes, 10 or 15 minutes, I'll stop and say, do people have questions about this part? Okay? Work okay? All right. So I'm going to start with a short prayer as usual. That's the end of the news, and it's so funny. Having been a journalist for 15 years, I still like to give people the news at the top of the hour, you know. This is the news from the KTC. The KTC is working on a building. We're gathering things, and it's great, and we have people on the prayer team and so forth and so on. So those are the headlines. Now I'm going to give a short talk based on this book, Meditation, Advice to Beginners by Bokhar Rinpoche. For the audio team, I forgot to send you a description of last week's talk, but I will send it this week because this week is part two. So I'll send you, I'll give you the dates of both talks, and the descriptions of both talks. That way you'll have them for posting. Folks who may or may not know this, but our Dharma talks are all posted online within a week or two after they happen. So if you miss a Dharma talk and want to catch up, you can go online and we'll fix you up. I was looking for my Dharma talk description and it was right in the book. The meditating mind is fertile ground, like farmland that can be tilled and planted. It starts with the idea that meditation is how we tame our minds, and this is going to talk a little bit more about the mind and why taming and training the mind is so useful to us. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. Before we start, I'm going to recite a short prayer in the Tibetan language. If it's a prayer you're familiar with, you can join in. And if it's a prayer you are not familiar with, you can join in your heart and in your mind, thinking that you dedicate this session to the benefit of sentient beings. I'll recite the four-line refuge prayer one time. O Sanje Chudang Soji Chonamla Jang Chu Pardu Dani Kyap Suchi Daji Jin So Ji Be Su Nam Ki Dro La Pin Shi Sanje Tru Parsho. O Palden Sawe Lama Rinpoche Tagi Chi War Pede Ten Shula Kadrin Jimbo Gone Che Sun Te Kusun Tugi Ngudrup Sao Du So. Okay, thank you. Once again, thanks for being here today. It is delightful to see you all. The practice of meditation is, I guess you could say, it's one of the best gifts we've ever received as human beings from the Buddha and all the great masters of the past who understood meditation, practiced meditation, taught meditation, did meditation. So you could say, in a way, that meditation is the best gift we possibly could get from an awakened being. Because by doing the practice of meditation, we learn a little bit about our own minds. And learning about our own minds is important to us. Because according to the teachings of the Buddha, he said, we are what we think. All that we are arises with our thoughts. And with our thoughts, we make the world. And so if we want to change our experience of the world, we change and work with our minds. But how do we work with our minds? What is the healthiest, best way to work with our minds? And it's by using the technique of meditation. And so the technique of meditation allows us to let go of our focus on the external world and all of its drama for a short period of time. You know, we don't meditate 24 hours a day. We only meditate for a short time every day, just as we only exercise for a short period of time each day, even we only eat for a short period of time each day. This is part of how we nourish our bodies and our minds in order to accomplish what needs to be done. And so meditation allows us to let go for a short period of time of our focus on and fixation on the externals of our life and the drama of our life. We actually take a short vacation from our everyday worries and our everyday concerns and let our mind come to rest on an object. And then when our attention wanders from that object, we gently take hold of our attention and replace it back on the object. This is meditation. I've met many people who have learned meditation in many different places. Lots of different techniques are used for meditation. Just this week, I met a person who learned meditation from YouTube. They actually learned meditation from YouTube videos. And the videos that they watched invited them to close their eyes and imagine that they were walking on a sandy beach and that the ocean was coming in. They were to imagine a scene. And in the scene, they were to meet a wise person. And that wise person was to impart information to them from their wisdom. That was the method of meditation that this person had learned from YouTube. And they said, "Is this the kind of meditation you do at the Buddhist Center?" And I said, "No, we don't do beaches. It's not that we don't like the sea. It's not that. It's that the Tibetans have different ways of making contact with the wisdom that is within us. We don't look at it as a wise person on a sandy beach by the ocean, but we do have a Buddha. We imagine the Buddha sometimes, and we imagine that the Buddha blesses us with golden light. He doesn't necessarily impart important information to us while we're meditating, but what does happen is that we imagine that he is present with us. He's present with us, and that he inspires us and gives us a blessing from his wisdom, and that's one method of meditation, but we have more. The method of meditation of visualizing the Buddha in front of you and imagining that you turn to him in prayer and request his blessing and that he shines golden light upon you and removes your negativities and complications and that he then dissolves into light and blesses you. This meditation has been around for a long time. In fact, Kempo Carter Rinpoche taught that meditation to us at the KTC in like 1979 or 1978, in somebody's living room. You know, he taught us how to do this. He said, if you're having trouble establishing a meditation practice, or if you're having trouble getting started with meditation, he said, have the Buddha help you. Imagine that the Buddha is there in front of you, and he's made of light. And he's not solid, he's made of beautiful golden light, and that he shines, you turn toward him and take refuge in him. I take refuge in the Buddha and so forth. And that then he shines light upon you that removes all of your obstacles to meditation, all of your obscurations that prevent you from meditating, and that he then dissolves into you and blesses you. And you just let your mind rest after that. And then you can do your meditation technique. And I was really touched by this little visualization. He had all of us do it in the room. We were all sitting together, and he had us meditate like that. And it was very useful. And I was able to teach it to people. In fact, I still teach it to people today as a method for calming their mind when their mind is in run-on sentence mode. Everybody has had a day like that, right? Your mind is running on and running on and running on. You can actually stop it for a moment by asking for the Buddha's help and having him enter your sphere of influence, so to speak, and invite him to give you a blessing. You can do that anytime. And in fact, my teacher, somehow maybe recognizing that I was a nervous person, I don't know how he would get that impression, but recognizing that I was a nervous person, he said, when you are feeling nervous, think of the Buddha and pray to the Buddha and take a blessing from the Buddha. And that was, I guess you could say, my first Buddhist practice was receiving this blessing from the Buddha. But the practice of meditation that he taught after that, imagining that after imagining that the Buddha is present with us and so forth and taking a blessing, the next form of meditation was the breath awareness meditation that we all know and are familiar with, where we allow our attention to rest on the breath as it goes out and rest on the breath as it comes in. And we then observe the breath with our attention, and then as the breath comes in and out, our attention may wander from the breath, and then we gently notice that it has wandered and bring it back over and over and over again. And we might do this for 5 minutes, or we might do this for 10 minutes or longer, but the idea is to establish a habit of daily meditation where we bring the mind back and bring it back gently without judgment. So that is the basic of meditation. And it's like, the reason I call it a gift is because I don't think that people naturally would meditate on their breath. They would probably be more naturally drawn to meditating on the ocean coming in from a sandy beach, perhaps, or the sounds of nature, the falling rain, or the movement of water in a brook. But all of these can be objects of meditation because they're continuous. The bubbling brook, the ocean, the rain, they allow us to rest our attention on something other than our run-on sentence mind. So that's a little bit about the technique of meditation. Does anybody have questions about the technique of meditation at this point? Okay, then I'll keep going. The topic for today is the fertile ground of the mind in meditation. What you'll notice after you meditate for a while is that you gain something that I have labeled like mental acuity. You actually begin to notice your thoughts when you are not meditating. At first, this can be a little disconcerting. Some people have told me, they've described it like when you meditate and then get up from meditation, it's like somebody turned up the volume on your thoughts. And you notice them more. And I've actually had people tell me that they've experienced this. And it's a little disconcerting at first because you're used to them being a little babble, babble, babble in the background. And now they're talking to you a little more loudly and it's a little disturbing. But the good news about this is that now you notice them, whereas before you didn't. And noticing them, you begin to notice how they influence you, how those thoughts influence you. I don't know I saw this lovely little graphic on the mindfulness website about the ABCs of meditation. And the idea is that when you notice, when you actually don't notice a thought, you don't notice it. What happens is your attention is drawn into a feeling, and then you get in a spin cycle with the feeling, and then it makes you go someplace else, and you're not in the present moment anymore. And then that feeling then flavors the next interaction you have with somebody. They use this example. They say you're in your workplace and somebody goes past you. They're talking to all their friends and they don't notice you. And then you think, oh, that person just disrespected me. They didn't look at me. They must not like me. And then we begin to feel a little depressed because somebody didn't notice us and didn't like us. And then we go into our next interaction where the boss corrects us for something we did wrong on the job. Even if the boss corrects us gently, we're still flavored by the memory of that person who disrespected us by not looking at us because we haven't let go of it yet. We're still holding on to that. And so then the boss says, oh, you need to do this task this way and not that way. And so then what happens is then we feel even more depressed. We think, oh, my boss doesn't like the way I do my work, and he has not liked it for some time. I'm so depressed. And so what will happen then is that will then flavor the next interaction that we have, and it goes on and on and on. Whereas when you meditate, you might be lucky and catch that first thought. Oh, that person didn't see me. They must be busy. Instead of saying that person didn't see me, they must not like me. You can begin to question. You can begin to actually question that thought. And to me, being able to question that thought is incredibly valuable. I am currently working with someone who lives in a different state, and we just had this conversation this week by email. They were saying, oh, I'm feeling somewhat depressed. And I said, oh, that's too bad. You know, how's meditation going? Oh, I can't meditate. And I said, oh, how did you get that idea? And they said, he said, my mind wanders a lot. And I said, okay. Well, then we started going back and going back and going back. And I said, well, what is going on in your mind right before you go off? And because he says he has a feeling and then the feeling runs away with him. The feeling just, it's like takes him away and runs away with him. I said, well, what are you thinking just the moment before that happens? Where are you and what are you thinking? And he couldn't tell me. He couldn't tell me what he was thinking. And I said, well, let's come up with an example, a silly example. And I didn't use the one on the poster that I just talked about, but I used some example, and he said, no, it's more like, and then he gave me an example. And I said, terrific. I said, so what we need to do is get a lever and go right in between those two moments. Do you think we can? And he said, it's worth a try. And so, but for him, the problem was he couldn't see the individual thoughts. So he didn't think he could get a lever in between them to take them apart. Because that's what he needed to do to get freedom from the depressed feeling. Like, oh, I can't meditate. I'm a bad person. I'm never going to get better. That was his thinking. And so we had to talk through it. Because I had a feeling that was what the problem was, that he couldn't tell the difference between those two thoughts. When the thought turned into a feeling, he couldn't quite go there. So anyway, it was a fascinating moment. And what it told me, because afterwards he said, I think I'm thinking differently about this now. I can see where the problem is. And he said, this will help me in a lot of areas. And he reminded me that he had just gotten to grad school and he was in his first semester of grad school studying psychology. He plans, his hope is to become a clinical psychologist to help people who have problems like his. And I think it's lovely. I wish him great success. And I told him I would pray for the success of his Dharma practice as well as the success of his studies. So anyway, it was a lovely conversation because it changed his mind about his ability to meditate. Because he thought that because he got distracted, he couldn't meditate. But the fact is, what he had to do was handle the distraction and return to meditation, even if it was for like 1 or 2 or 3 seconds, and that would give him a feeling of success. And I said, oh, and just wait, there's more. I said, because what will happen is that once you get this acuity, once you can begin to see the individual thoughts, you can begin to insert helpful thoughts so that you can let the helpful thoughts run away with you and not just the negative ones, the positive ones. You can have the positive ones like, I pray or I aspire that I and all beings are free from negativity. I aspire that I and all beings are free from depression or sadness. You know, I pray that all of these things happen for all beings and they're all free. So that was sort of where that conversation went. And so the reason I bring up these stories is because it illustrates that the mind is fertile ground. We can actually change the soil of our minds. If you think of your mind as being like a field, we can actually begin to condition it with nutrients, things that are healthy for the mind. We can actually begin to add compassion and wisdom into our minds. Even if we may think we don't have enough, free-floating wisdom or free-floating compassion. We may not think we have enough, but we can enrich our minds with these things and make our minds more workable. And so this is why it's this particular section of the book is called this, The Mind is Fertile Ground. It's because the mind is where we live. We live with our minds. Our bodies convey information, but our minds are what experience it. So if we want to change our experience, we change our mind. So where we left off last week, we spoke a little bit last week about working with objects in meditation. And then today we were going to talk about knowing how to meditate and then working with questions, the various questions and answers. When he spoke about meditating on the mind, this is a little bit of a subtle object. The breath is a pretty solid object, and last we were talking about meditating on a stone and so forth and so on. But there are other things you can meditate on as well. And you can actually allow the mind to rest in a, he says here, of openness and relaxation. He said, but if that's difficult to allow your mind to rest in a sense of openness and relaxation, most people can only manage it for a few seconds. He said, you can actually also recite prayers or mantras and so forth, such as the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum. Some people find that when they anchor their attention to a sound like Om Mani Padme Hum, which is the name of Chenrezig, the Bodhisattva of Compassion, this helps them a lot. And so this way we can see through our practice of meditation that it is our mind and how our mind thinks that determines our experience, and that when we learn how to drop a thought, we learn how to change our minds. When you can drop a single thought in meditation, that means your mind becomes more workable. The field, the fertile field of your mind becomes more workable. And so meditation is not trying to stop your thoughts. It's about noticing your thoughts and not becoming carried away by them, and instead changing your object of attention to the breath and returning the mind to its object. And in the question and answer section of this text, Bokhar Rinpoche addresses some questions that people ask when they begin practicing meditation. One of the people asked, what is the significance of meditation for our life, both now and in the future? And he said, if by meditating we can awaken to the ways that we get in our own path, if we can discern what our faults and failings are and begin to leave those faults and failings behind, and we can see our qualities and begin to enrich those qualities, he said, this is a very good thing that we can do. And this can make our future more meaningful. It can make our future more free of suffering. Someone asked him what the significance of meditation was for future lives in existence. And he said, well, if by meditating we attain awakening in this life, we will immensely help other beings through Buddha activity in our future life. But even if we are not able to attain awakening in this lifetime, the habit of meditation that we have created now will carry through. It will carry through and allow us to learn and meditate more easily in the future. I have met people who say enlightenment in this life or bust, you know? Like the old people who went west, right? You know, westward or bust, you know, the idea. But I've met people, and if they meet good teachers and they practice well, then they will be able to attain enlightenment in this lifetime. But even if they can't do that, the habit of meditation that they develop in this lifetime will carry through into the future. This great Lama I met a few years ago said, if you improve 1% in this lifetime, 100 lifetimes, you'll be Buddha. And the fact of the matter is, we will probably improve more than 1% in this lifetime. And what is the goal of human life? He said, the goal of human life is to transcend suffering and to help others who are lost in suffering now. And then another person said, well, I'm learning about my mind as I meditate, but what is this mind? And is this what reincarnates and goes from life to life? And his answer is very, very good. He said, it is first necessary to understand how the mind operates before we understand about its future. He says, when someone says something pleasant to us, it creates a certain happiness in us. When something tells us something disagreeable, on the other hand, a certain unhappiness takes shape in our minds. That which experiences the pleasant or unpleasant is what we call mind. If, however, we look at the essence of what was experienced, we find that there is no color, no shape, no form, and no atoms or molecules, nothing material in the mind. In this sense, you could say that our mind is empty of solidity and empty of atoms and molecules and materiality. Although it is said to be not a material thing, it is nonetheless not nothing because it knows and it experiences. And so it is therefore impossible to say anything about the mind that is material. You can't say that it's made of wood, you can't say it's made of metal, and so forth. So he says, right now, he said, let's say that you are occupied with the glass of water in front of you. Delicious. When your mind is occupied with the glass, your mind is then the thought of the glass of water. That's your mind. That's what your mind is doing. It's taking the shape of a glass of water right now. Your mind is doing that. Then, when you look at another object, such as my watch, if I look at my watch, then my mind has traveled somewhere, has changed its object, and it's actually sort of gone somewhere. But the glass has ceased to exist. Because now I'm interested in my watch. So did the glass like totally disappear? No, it's kind of still there. Buddhists will argue about this, by the way. You'll get Buddhist philosophers who will argue about whether that glass of water ceases to exist when you, I mean, you know, Buddhist philosophers will disagree about whether the glass ceases to exist when you stop drinking from it and turn your attention to something else. But for your mind is now with the watch. And so he says, this is what happens when you go from life to life. You are absorbed with the thoughts and experiences of this situation, and then you go to a different situation and are absorbed in those thoughts. And he said there is a continuity of the person who is absorbed with the glass and the person who is absorbed with the watch. There is a continuity there, but you can't necessarily describe it as something, because after all, it's empty of solidity. He said, we can understand this continuity of the mind in noticing that in the morning, the thought processes resume from the day before, and in spite of the interruption of all the thoughts and dreams you had while you were asleep, you still pick up and you still have to go to work. You know, you wake up in the morning, still got to go to work. And so he said, the passage from a past life to a future one unfolds under the same principle. There is a continuity between the mind which experiences the present day and the mind that experiences the following day. The same continuity exists between the mind that experiences this present life and the future life and so forth. And he said, considering karma, it is also necessary to understand that this concerns the mind. And finally, it also is not material, but although it is not material, it conditions, karma conditions how you experience things. How I experience this, a glass of water, is going to depend on how I experienced it in the past and so forth and so on. How I experience this watch is going to be dependent on how I feel about time, as well as how I feel about Mickey Mouse. So there are lots of things that condition how we experience things, and those are our karmic accumulations, our accumulated experiences. And those are things we carry with us from one moment to the next. And this is another reason why the mind is called fertile ground, because if we can condition our experience in one moment, we can condition it in another moment. And so that's a little bit about the mind as fertile ground. Next Sunday, I'll be talking next Sunday on a different topic. So the next 2 weeks, I will be outside the book and giving different Dharma talks. And when I was at my retreat the other week, a couple of people had some ideas for Dharma talks. And so we're going to be doing some Dharma talks the next couple of weeks about compassion and about the application of compassion in daily life. So we're going to be talking about those in the next couple of weeks. Plus, if you have any specific things, I will take requests. Starting at the beginning of the talk next week, I will also ask for requests for future Dharma talks. So you have a week to start thinking about stuff that you might want to have me talk about on my Dharma talk days. Because on Eric's, and I think Eric and Marcus and Kathy Jackson, I think, are going to continue the study of this book. And I'll be giving some freestanding. I just wanted to talk about this particular topic because I liked it. But I'll be doing Dharma talks on other subjects. So we have some time for questions. Questions, curiosities, things you want to know about meditation, meditation problems you might have, anything you might want to ask about. I may have to ask you questions. Okay, here we go. We have, okay, you'll bite. All right, very good. We have the question microphone in the front for questions. That way folks who listen to the recorded talks can hear you as well.
Okay, so when you were talking about the mind as fertile ground.
Yeah.
I got to think about the Dalai Lama has said, he's a real science nerd. And he said, if science disproves parts of Buddhism, we'll update Buddhism.
Yeah.
And so, when you say what we're saying, fertile ground, would that be like analogous to neuroscience finding that our brains have neuroplasticity? Because, you know, when we went through biology, we were taught, here's your brain, good luck.
Here's your brain, good luck. Yeah, okay.
Go forward.
Right?
But it seems like modern science is finding that our brain can, like, we do regenerate, it can new habits, and there's, would that be the same as a fertile ground concept?
You know, I can't say, because he appears to be saying that the mind is changeable, yes. But but of course, neuroplasticity is about the matter of the brain. And, you know, it's a chicken and egg thing that I'm still not sure I understand exactly. Because the mind, because I was talking with somebody about this. We had it, this was while we were on the elevator after the board meeting on Thursday night. We have very interesting conversations in the elevator going up and down from our board meetings. And we were talking about whether the brain was the mind or whether the mind was the brain. And we do not know. We could not, in the elevator, we could not come up with a decision on that. But kind of what I shared was what I've heard from some of the Buddhist teachers who have said that our body, which includes our brain, okay, which includes our brain, is produced by the karma of our previous lifetime. So this body and mind that we have right now, which includes the brain, was produced by our previous karma, both positive and negative. So you could say that our mind produced our body, and then the body becomes a support for the mind, which interpenetrates it. That's often what is discussed. But then the mind can have an impact on the brain, you see, because of the special relationship between the mind and the body. They impact each other. So did I just put myself in a corner?
No.
Or am I in a loop?
It's making me jump to, like, we know with individuals who have multiple personality disorders,
mm-hmm.
that the brain functioning can look very different between the personalities. And one person might test positive for diabetes,
mm-hmm.
and another one not.
I'm really interested in. I would love to know what's going on there karmically. I would super love
That's
to know.
Over the
I would.
Stuff you're talking about.
Absolutely. I would super love to know how it is that a person with multiple personalities could test positive for diabetes in one personality but not in another.
Yeah.
That blows my mind. Okay,
mind sure.
blown.
If you're
okay.
giving insulin, make sure you know.
Yeah, who's getting it? Who's getting
because
it?
Because you could really harm somebody.
Yeah, no, I know.
No, what you were saying just...
Yeah, but I honestly don't...
Concept.
It is a concept that I can't fathom. So we would have to go to the great minds of Buddhism to ask them that question. I would be very fascinated to know how a person such as Kempo Carter Rinpoche, you know, the great wise Lama who founded this center, the Tibetan Lama, I'd love to hear how he addresses that possibility. Because I honestly don't know. Honestly don't know. No.
But yes, I'd love to hear his answer.
I'd love to hear his answer, yeah. So, okay.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, no, thanks. Every now and then, it's good to have questions I can't answer. My teacher taught me he said, there are three powerful words. I don't know. Because he said, if you don't know, that means you get to learn something. Because then you get to go look it up. Which would mean I would have to talk to one of the great minds of our tradition. Are there any other questions? Because we have maybe 5 minutes. If not, we can always meditate. Oh, here comes a question. Okay. Okay, comments, okay. Comment, question.
You were soliciting ideas for next week.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mentioned before, and I'm going to repeat today, that I have a problem really understanding what compassion is.
Okay.
And.
Oh, good.
So
okay.
I think that I would like you to start with that so I get an idea. Is it empathy for the other person? Is it trying to put yourself into their shoes?
Mm-hmm.
Or, I mean, I just don't quite get what it is. So.
Sure. I appreciate that.
And I feel like that's all the books are written about compassion. I should be better able to work with it. So.
Yeah, I understand that.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, yeah, I can definitely do that. I can give you a short answer to that today, and then we'll expand on it, okay? The short answer came in a lecture that Kemper Rinpoche gave a number of years ago at the Columbus KTC, where he talked about a Buddhist teaching called the Four Immeasurable Thoughts or the Four Immeasurable Meditations. He said, it's the meditation on love, the meditation on compassion, the meditation on joy, and the meditation on equanimity. And he said, usually people talk about them in that order. He said, but I'm going to switch the order because it's significant. So he started talking about equanimity first. And he said that equanimity comes from understanding that other people are just like you. Because this is really important, and not a lot of people recognize this. Because we are different from one another. I mean, we have a nose and eyes and mouth, and so we sort of look like each other, and we sort of walk around on two legs, and, you know, we do all the things that people do, right? We have hands and the whole thing. Because we have a similar appearance and yet we're different, there is a mistake that we can make. And the mistake is that we can think that these people who look different from us are different from us. And then we can start to create narratives and stories in our thoughts. Well, that person is a this, or that person is a that. This person is good. That person is bad. You see what I'm saying? And we can make them seem even more different than us. We can actually increase the difference between ourselves and others just by how we think about them. In that example that I gave earlier about the person who disrespects me because they didn't look at me when I walked by them, I could make up a whole narrative in my mind, and it's all made up because it didn't really happen, right? They actually passed by me without speaking to me, but it wasn't that they passed by me because they didn't like me. They were busy. But I wasn't willing to see that, and so I made up a story. And then after that, I might choose to ignore them or to think badly about them, and then it could get worse and worse and worse until I actually wanted to harm that person. You know, criticize, ostracize, marginalize, demonize. You see how human beings can make that happen. We see it in public life, and I think that's all I'll say about that. Okay? But we see this. We criticize people, we ostracize people, we marginalize people, and then we demonize people, and then we could really hurt them. So we can do this on an individual basis. We don't have to be a nation thinking about other nations or a people thinking about other people. We can be just you and me thinking about each other. And so equanimity, by meditating on equanimity, we are to think, you know, that person is just like me. They want to be happy, but they don't know how to do it. And in that way, they're just like me. And they make mistakes just like me. And they want things just like me. And they fear things just like me. And so the idea is to dwell upon and think about the sameness of us and other people. And that may give birth to the second immeasurable, which is the wish for them to be happy. Because we want to be happy. And so we might actually have that spark of saying, wow, I wish they were happy. I wish they could have good things. I wish I could have good things. I wish they could have good things. And then that might also give rise to the next feeling, well, I'd also like for them to not suffer anymore. I want them to stop suffering. Oh my gosh, they're going through so many terrible things. I wish they wouldn't suffer. You see what I'm saying? And those are the first three of the four. Equanimity gives rise to love, which is the wish for others to be happy, and the wish for others to be free of suffering is the Buddhist definition of compassion, the wish for them to be free. And a lot of people throw the word around, as you say, they throw around the word love, and they throw around the word compassion without really knowing what it means. But that's the short version of the meaning. So I appreciate you asking about it, and we'll talk more about it in the next two talks, okay? Yeah, thanks. Time for one more. Is there one more out there? Did you have a question, Thomas? Yeah, well, pick one. Pick one. Can't pick one? All right, that's all right. But I just wanted to give you an opportunity. Yeah. Yeah, great. Thank you for being here. Well, then we'll sit quietly and mentally dedicate the goodness of this this talk and our discussion together. We dedicate this goodness to all beings who suffer, and we pray that all beings are free from their suffering, that they come to happiness, and then that they come to Buddhahood and liberation from all suffering, and that they then emanate in all directions and benefit sentient beings endlessly. We mentally dedicate the goodness with this thought in mind. Okay, thank you, thank you, thank you. Thank you.